Morning, everybody. Damien Harris is my name from Mills Oakley, and I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of Greens List and pay a special thank you to Michael for putting on another exemplary breakfast at a very reasonable cost, and we get our CPD point and a lovely breakfast as well, plus some terrific insights into the wonderful world of tax and the interaction with family law. And I think it says a lot about the quality of our speakers and the subject matter today that we've got such a good turnout and of some of the most high profile and highly regarded family law practitioners in the audience. So thanks very much for making the effort to come along, everyone. I made a decision fairly early on that I was never going to be a tax lawyer, and I think that might have something to do with the fact that my eyes often glazed over in the lectures with Professor Wayne Symer out at Monash Uni back in the late 1980s, and I sometimes regret that decision because I'm sure whilst family lawyers are all very well paid, I'm pretty sure tax barristers are on another scale altogether. Indeed, I celebrated 23 years in practice this year, and I recall as a young lawyer calling an eminent tax barrister at the behest of my then principal to get some advice, and I said to him when I finally got hold of him, look, Mark's asked me to give you a call. We need to know what you'll charge us to answer three straightforward questions. And he said, well, I know Mark well. He's my normally hourly rate's $1,200, but what about as a favour to Mark, I'd charge you $900. And I said to him, $900? Gee, that's a bit steep, isn't it? And he said, no, I think that's pretty reasonable. Now, what's your third question? The former US Secretary of State, Donald Rumsfeld, made the immortal quote, there are known knowns. These are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we don't know we don't know. Now, I'm sure this morning, regrettably, we're going to find out a few more unknown unknowns in the world of tax insofar as it impacts upon family law. And we're very grateful to have the wonderful expertise of Peter and Julianne to assist us in guiding us through some of the critical issues that we're going to confront more often than not as our settlements become more and more complicated insofar as tax is concerned. Our first speaker is Peter Crofts, a member of Greens List, and who no doubt is known to most of us in the audience. Peter was admitted to practice in 1982 and he signed the Victorian Bar Roll in November 2001. He's since established a real niche as a barrister practising in family law with the ability to inject his considerable expertise from an accounting and taxation background. Peter practised for many years as a partner and in-house counsel with Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu, one of the then, I think it was Big Eight firms as they then were. Prior to that, he also had experience with the National Crime Authority and practised with a city law firm. Peter's got a very diverse, predominantly commercially based practice and practices in areas of not only family law but restraint of trade, ASIC matters, franchise disputes, superannuation and so on. I know from personal experience that Peter is often involved in some of the high profile and very complicated financial matters that we see in our jurisdiction, often assisting senior counsel in being able to assist in the examination of complex accounting and taxation issues, particularly with respect to forensic valuations and the like. So if you could all welcome Peter, he's going to talk to us about some of the general tax issues relevant to the resolution of matrimonial property proceedings.
Thank you, Damien. Family lawyers have it tough, don't they? They've got to know about employment law. They've obviously got to know about family law. They get caught up in franchising. They have to be able to deal with business valuations. And despite Damien's nice disclaimer, they've really got to understand their tax. Added to all of that, they've got to be up at 7:30 in the morning to come to CPDs. My task, I hope, is to talk about tax issues which probably all of you will have be aware of or have dealt with, but perhaps to put them in a slightly different context and make you think about the same issues in a different way. I'm not sure that there's anything particularly new. Hopefully you'll slowly wake up and adjust as the coffee sinks in, and you'll then be bright-eyed for the more detailed and complex material that Julianne's talking about. Like all, I've tried to divide the tax issues into the way that I see family law cases running. Things we need to know about when we're determining the matrimonial pool, things we need to know about when we're affecting a resolution, and things we need to give consideration to post-resolution. Disclaimer, like all good people practising in the tax area, this paper is not meant to be tax advice. Things to think about in considering the matrimonial pool. Tax refunds or assessments, valuation of tax losses and CGT. Really, these are all about understanding how the tax system works. For those of us who are employed, we get our paycheck every week, fortnight, month, and the tax has been deducted. For those running their own business, when they fill out their quarterly BAS return, there is a prediction of what they will earn, and tax is assessed and paid at the same time. PAYG, pay as you go. But it's assessed on last year's earnings, the last tax return you filed. So, how many of us have had the case where hubby says, oh gee, you know, post-separation the business is going down, I'm not earning anywhere near as much as I used to? And maybe that's genuine. He's not concentrating on the business, he's genuinely distressed by the matrimonial, he's concentrating on the new partner. But one of the effects will be, if he's not earning as much, he's going to get a tax refund, isn't he? And that's an asset. And have you booked it? And the other variation on that is wife, who's been sharing income with husband in their business. Business has been making $400 a year, so wife's been getting $200. They separate. The business has paid the tax on it. On $200, there's about $75, $80 in tax, so she's been getting $120 in the bank. They separate. There's a spousal maintenance fight. Hubby's ordered to pay her $2,000 a month. He continues to do so, but of course he pays it in exactly the same way through the business, tax deductible to him, and the business continues to pay the tax. Final resolution is achieved. Everyone goes their own way. Wife puts in a tax return. She says, hang on, the business has paid for me $80,000 in tax, but I only earned $24,000, so I'd like it all back, please. Did you pick it up for husband that she was going to get $80,000? And if not, why not? So think about whether there are refunds or liabilities that should be assessed when you're preparing your statement of financial circumstances. Tax losses. If a business has made losses, then there's on the slide I use the figure of $100,000. The net result will be that next year it's able to earn $100,000 before it pays any tax. If it's a corporate structure and it earned $100,000, it would pay $30 in tax. So the first $100 that it earns is effectively tax-free. It's not, in one sense, it's recouping the loss, but in terms of a cash flow sense, it is. Now, there are all sorts of complicated tax rules about using tax losses. Got to be basically same shareholders, same business. But if the company is something that husband's been the sole shareholder in, and he's continuing the business, there is no doubt that he's going to continue it. You might find that the valuer's gone off and said, oh, you know, buying tax losses in the marketplace, only 3 or 4 cents in the dollar. But without getting into the issue of value to owner, to hubby, they're worth the full 30 cents, perhaps discounted by the fact that he's going to get it sometime in the future. But it's an asset, again, in his hands, that you might care to look at and have valued. And you're going to see that in the balance sheet. You're going to see either accumulated losses or you're going to see accumulated profits. And if there are accumulated profits, there's going to be an associated franking account. Because if it's a company, the company will have paid tax on those profits. and unless they've been distributed, which they shouldn't be if they're sitting there accumulated in the balance sheet, there's going to be franking credits sitting there for someone's use. Again, have you identified it and valued it? It's an asset that can be taken into account in the statement of financial circumstances. I want to touch on CGT because typically we all sit there and we say, oh yes, if the asset's going to be sold to affect the settlement or because the court orders require it, there's CGT, we'll get that quantified. And that's pretty much where we stop. But go back and read Rosati. Point two in paragraph 92804 of the family law cases version. If the court orders the sale of an asset or is satisfied that a sale of it is inevitable or would probably occur in the near future, that's what we're really talking about. That's what everyone does and knows, the first few lines. But it goes on. Or if the asset is one which was acquired solely as an investment and with a view to its ultimate sale for profit. How many of us have had family law cases where the couple bought an investment property? Clearly bought for investment. Did they say when they're going to sell it? Did they think about it was intended to be sold for profit? Usually, oh, it's part of our retirement. There is an intention, perhaps not very well specified, but when you take your instructions for your early material, you're going to pursue that line, aren't you? Because you might be able to bring that property in under the second limb of Rosati. And the third part, or the third paragraph, or section in the same paragraph, if none of the circumstances in two applies, that is, it's not going to immediately be sold and it wasn't bought for investment with the intention of sale, but the court is satisfied that there is a significant risk that the asset will have to be sold in the short to mid-term, then the court can make an adjustment under 75.20, any other factor. So if you've got investment properties or share portfolios and you can get instructions that accord with those sections of Rosati, you've got the basis for saying that the court should consider the CGT liability. Now, if you don't get the background material and then don't go on and quantify it, the court isn't going to be able to. But you're missing out on something that may be of particular use to your client. What are you looking for? You're looking as to whether there is any evidence of investment, what the evidence of sale is, and then, and to me this is probably the most important bit, if you've got that, you've got an excuse for involving the party's accountant. Now, you want them to quantify it. In my view, the accountant often has a closer relationship with the client than you do, particularly if you're for husband, he's the accountant for the business, and he's made the practical election. He acted for wife, husband, and all their entities, but he knows where the business is going to stay, so he knows where his future income's coming from, so he's continuing to act for husband. You want him on your side, not working against you. You want the accountant to be supporting you in the things you're trying to do in the family court. Not saying, oh, the, you know, they should be more aggressive or they should be doing this or they should be doing the other thing. So as a significant influencer of your client, you want an excuse to talk to him. You want an excuse to involve him. And this is just giving you one. And of course, if you're for wife, which you will be 50% of the time, I presume, you've got the opportunity to do something good. To refer a client, get her away from that dreadful accountant who's really not interested in her, get her some sensible advice on how she's going to invest these proceeds and survive in the future, and get the CGT liabilities calculated. Of course, in doing all of that, you've also done the useful thing of deferring your own liability for failing to consider tax issues. Let me move to issues relevant to resolution. I've only dealt with income tax, CGT and GST in the paper. I haven't dealt with all the other imposts, flood levies and so forth that might be around and relevant. I'm not touching on income tax or tax consequences from companies or trusts, because they raise the real issue of Division 7A, and Julianne will do that so much better than I. Let me start with GST. Normally we don't think about it terribly much, but again it goes back to understanding how tax works. GST only applies to businesses, to enterprises. So if we're dealing with private assets, it's not relevant. But if my wife buys me a beautiful antique leather couch to put in my chambers, very sensibly, she gives me the receipt to show me how generous she was in my Christmas present. But I, of course, give that to my accountant and claim the GST because it was an expense incurred in my business. When I move floors in Owen Dixon and move to a new, sparse, white set of chambers where the antique couch doesn't fit, I upset my wife by selling the couch, and of course I pay GST on the money I get from the couch. Should we split, and my wife say to me, "Peter, I really want that couch, I'd put a lot of effort into that," and I give her the couch, then it's a disposal. It's a private disposal, so there's no income tax. Forgive me, the 5 of 2006, I think, the ruling is in the paper talking about no disposal in matrimonial circumstances doesn't count at any event. But what does count is that I've claimed the input tax credit. When I bought the couch, I claimed the benefit. I'm supposed to go back and adjust my tax return because now I've disposed of it without claiming the or admitting to the tax I should have collected on the disposal. Now, this raises in an indirect way the problems of self-reporting. We operate in a system where our clients tell the tax office a story, and subject to orders and investigation, the tax office accept the story. We're in the more difficult position as professionals in that we can't encourage them to lie or tell untruths. But to what extent do we have to warn them of these consequences, or at least alert them to them, alert them to those? GST is one example. Is it really necessary to raise with your client, "Oh well, if you're doing this, there could be some input tax credits"? I think it probably is on GST. That way you've covered yourself and there's a line in your letter. There is the old one from the Tax Measures No. 4 Act. You appreciate that the exemption from CGT for the matrimonial home or the is based on it being your residence. When husband moves out, it ceases to be his residence. The exemption no longer applies to his interest in the home. Now, normally it doesn't make terribly much difference because he moves out in January and we settle in the next January and there hasn't been terribly much increase in the property price or any real issue, and in any event it's only half of that increase that could be subject to tax. But if it's been rezoned or it's been a very long time between, there could be a significant increase in the value of the property, therefore a significant capital gain, and half of that no longer has the exemption applying to it. We don't deal with it because we say, "Oh, there's rollover relief," and there is, transferring from one party to a marriage to another, so it passes under the board. And then 5 years later, the wife sells the home. Of course, she will fill out her self-reporting form saying, "This is my home, it's my residence, I claim the main residence exemption, no CGT." But if it were investigated, the extent to which the property had increased whilst husband was not living in it was a capital gain. it rolled over to her, and she gets to pay tax on it when it's sold. Again, do we need to raise these sorts of issues? The final one, but only because it was the subject of an accounting note that ran around many family law practitioners a year or two ago. Most of us draw terms which transfer an asset, or say that the parties hold these things on trust pending compliance with these orders or terms. Well, there's an argument that that's a disposal to a trust. A disposal to a trust is not CGT exempt. So that disposal is subject to CGT. If I draw the terms these days, I don't have that in there. I wasn't really sure why we did it, except everyone did it. These are examples of where tax is complicated. I've never heard of the Commissioner ever enforcing any of those issues, but it's a decision that I think you as practitioners have got to be aware of and make. On CGT rollover, you appreciate, of course, that it's really the taxing of a profit. If you buy an asset and sell it at a gain, it's really being put that that's a profit. That profit is then added to your income from other sources and taxed. So there are issues that can be played with where the wife perhaps is going to be on a low income and we've got capital gains that we want to distribute. Well, let's give them to her because she will pay less tax on them than if they go to the husband on a high income. There are also ways of minimising capital gain. There's the personal exemption that applies to 50% if it's in your own name. There are the small business exemptions. If it's an active asset, something the business is using, then you can apply a 50% exemption on top of the one you've already had, so you're down to 25%. If you then are transferring it for use in retirement, you can take another 50% off, so you're down to only paying 12.5% paying tax on 12.5% of the gain. Why is that important? Well, for those of you who listened to the first part of the presentation and said, gee, I'm going to go off and quantify all these capital gains and put them in, on the other side, you're going to turn around and say, yes, but have you applied any of the relevant exemptions to reduce the amounts that are actually being taxed? Don't accept, Your Honour, that there's 100,000 capital gains tax. Really, if he did these things, all of which are available to him, it would only be 12.5. It's important to remember that rollover relief, which we all are used to, doesn't actually exempt from tax. It simply defers it. It seems to me that there are benefits in having it quantified anyway, even if you can't use it in your arguments, because at some point your client's going to have to pay it, and having some understanding of what they might have to pay is better than having it hidden and then being stuck with a big asset or a big bill, particularly if that occurs in the next few years because of some other change. It's also worth remembering that when things are transferred, we have to have some agreement on value. Market substitution rules apply. In essence, what is the market price? Where there have been arguments about value, it is, in my view, useful to actually quantify what you've agreed the value to be, because otherwise, at some point in time, someone's left with coming back saying, what was that value? And all you've got's a disputed range. Perhaps I deal with it later, but perhaps on that point I should merely talk about indemnities. We of course tend to say, oh, don't worry about things, you're indemnified. Indemnities are only as good as the paper they're written on, of course, if someone's gone off and restructured them. And it's another issue that perhaps should be raised with the client, that this is what the indemnity is, but you've got to be satisfied that it's going to be of use to you. Said I wouldn't talk about Div 7A. Loan accounts and losses. When Julianne talks to you, you will understand how important understanding where the money's come from is. It's easy if we can simply say the husband will pay the wife X dollars. But we tend to say the husband will pay or cause to be paid. As soon as it's caused to be paid, where's it actually coming from? if it's coming from somewhere else, there may or may not be tax consequences. And that means that loans can be very important. Now, when we get an expert accountant to value things, they tend to just disregard inter-entity and related party loans. And they do that because, of course, it doesn't really matter that the company owes $100,000 to the husband. If I treat it as a liability in the company, I've got to then recognise it as an asset for the husband. And so it's easy just to knock them all out, and the net result is the company's value goes up a bit. Two problems with that. First of all, it's amazing how many times when you actually reconcile those inter-entity loans, they don't balance. They should. But it's a lovely point for a cross-examiner as to why the company accounts don't balance. That means they must be wrong, so you're really asking the court to rely on wrong accounts. And that's always a lovely point for me to have. But if no one's done the work, I haven't got it, or I've got to do it myself. The other point is, by having them quantified, you've got some concept of where monies are coming from and what's got to be done with those loans. Transferring losses, I just alert you to the fact that if they're coming from trusts, you need inter-entity, you need family trust elections. So again, you're going back to the accountant saying, have I got all of these to deal with losses? And on the issue of liquidation, people often, or I've often heard it said, oh, don't worry about that entity, it's not got much in it, we'll just liquidate it. And I've even seen orders written saying that the parties will do all acts and things necessary to appoint a voluntary administrator to and liquidate entity X. Typically, the parties will have one share in it each that they have bought for $1. If the net result is that the entity, after the liquidation and the liquidator's costs, turns out anything more than a dollar, you've got a capital gain. So if someone talks about liquidations, be very careful. I've talked about indemnities briefly. One of the problems that, of course, keeps coming up for all of us is there's been cash. One day I'm actually going to act for a family law client who does pay tax. I think I must be the only stupid person in the area who fills out their returns regularly. Parties tend to forget that if tax hasn't been paid, directly or indirectly, they've both had the benefit of the extra cash. I had in the past taken the view that, oh well, the tax office was swamped with work, they were understaffed, and who was going to deal with the rabbitings on of a dissatisfied ex-spouse? I've had the opportunity of working more closely with the tax office on a number of matters. I regret to advise that such an approach is wrong, that complaints from disgruntled ex-spouses subject only to staffing availability are taken seriously, and therefore if you're thinking about what you can do in these circumstances, be very careful about giving an indemnity that all the wrongs of the past will be met by your client, and make very sure that the wrongs of the past are met by both clients. It's all I can think of as a means of dissuading the disgruntled spouse that this all might come back to bite them. Damien kindly mentioned franchises. Let me finish slightly with a franchise point. Some of you might have seen or remember those machines that the dough plops down into the hot oil and the little metal track goes along and flips the donut over and then it goes into the spinning bin of cinnamon. They were actually designed by the American Army to repatriate returning ex-servicemen from the Second World War so that they could take a machine and go home to their country town and set up a donut and coffee shop. And it was the first real franchise. They borrowed the name of a well-known donut store in Rhode Island, Downey Flake, and some of you might remember Downey Flake when they had stores in Chadston and Northland. On the wall in their stores was a little tile mosaic which had two men standing looking at their donuts. One had a very big donut, but it had a very big hole. The other had a more regular-sized donut, but it was nearly all donut. And the rhyme on the wall went something like, "As you wander through life, brother, whatever be your goal, keep your eye upon the donut and not upon the hole." The point of that in relevance to tax is that people can get very carried away with keeping an eye on how much tax they pay and how much tax these settlements are going to cost. The idea is that tax should be considered but never drive the settlement, or at least if you believe Downey Flake, that would be the case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Peter, for a great presentation, and yes, it's one of my father's favourite quotes as well. He's often reminded me of that. We will shortly break for a coffee break, but we probably have some time for some very quick questions, if anyone has any questions they'd like to ask of Peter. Peter, I have one question, and that is in relation to the second limb of the Rosati ratio, if you like, regarding the quantification of capital gains tax. Where the parties have acquired a property for investment purposes with a view to reselling, how problematic does it become to quantify the likely gain, gain and therefore the likely tax, if, for example, the evidence is that the property may not be disposed of for several years? And in your experience, what is the court's approach to that issue?
It clearly is problematic. All you can really do is say, if the property were sold now, this is what the capital gain would be, and these are the exemptions or reductions that would be available. What is the court's approach to it? In the last 4 months, I've had Justice Bennett take it into account as a 75-20 factor on two occasions.
Because no doubt you're beholden to the vagaries of the market and so on in the intervening years.